Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. We have Rich Lenkoff from Downey & Lenkoff. I'm your moderator, Ryan Bro. Tina Martini of Deckard is on assignment this week. Well, a federal judge has struck down the Pentagon's new restrictive press policy as unconstitutional. The Trump administration has really tried to crack down on reporter access to officials of the Pentagon. Katie Townsend is a partner at Gibson Dunn in Washington, D.C., a former legal director of Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. She has a deep understanding of the media and the First Amendment law. Thanks so much for coming out with us.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Katie, so we know that in your former role, you successfully led a fight against Pentagon press policy. In this situation, explain to us first what the Pentagon did and what the policy meant, and then how the federal court reacted to that most recently.
Sure. So in late last year, in October, the Pentagon announced a new and really unprecedented new policy pertaining to press credentials. Folks at the press in the press corps who cover the Pentagon on a daily basis have credentials that allow them to come in the building and go to press conferences and ask questions. The policy in question imposed, again, unprecedented restrictions that folks who had been covering the Pentagon for decades had never seen before. And really, at its core, we can go through the many constitutional infirmities that the district court found in the policy. But I think at its core, what it aimed at doing was giving Pentagon officials the ability to pull credentials, to revoke journalist credentials if they didn't like what questions were being asked, if they didn't like what stories were being published for any reason, and really for no reason at all. And that is sort of really, I think, the core of certainly what our clients, the New York Times and its reporter Julian Barnes, objected to when they sued to enjoin enforcement of that policy.
Seems pretty obvious that that shouldn't happen, right? In a democracy, one branch of the government shouldn't be able to shut down questions that they don't like from the press. So what was the justification that the Pentagon, Department of War, what justification did they give? Ultimately, thankfully, that the judge struck down, but what was the initial alleged basis for this policy?
Yeah, I think it's changed over time, I will say. But I think if you ask the department what their concerns are, I think they would probably tell you at this point, at least, that they want to protect the safety and security of personnel at the Pentagon. I will tell you that journalists that work in the Pentagon every day have that same, or used to work in the Pentagon every day, have those same concerns. They don't pose, and I think this is an important fact, the district court squarely held that any kind of concerns about safety or security didn't justify this policy. You have folks who have been covering the Pentagon from Pentagon grounds for decades and had background security checks done and had been cleared to be in the building. This wasn't really about, and this is what goes to the core, the sort of heart of the court's order, this wasn't about safety. This wasn't about security. This was about editorial viewpoint discrimination. The Pentagon leadership wanting journalists in the building who would only report information that they wanted them to report, authorized, approved information, and not asking questions that went beyond that.
Katie, why is it important, at the risk of asking you an obvious question, but it's really illustrative, I think. Why is it important, especially during a time of war, particularly a time of war that has, to most Americans, a majority of Americans by every poll, not been adequately explained in basic terms? Why is it important in this time to have journalists, reporters, to ask the hardest questions and not exclude them from the room?
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, having reporters in the building covering the Pentagon is really about serving the interest of the public. Certainly, as you said, at a time of war, it could not be more important than for everyone and every American to be getting fact-based, accurate information in a timely way about military engagements across the globe, including with respect to the ongoing war in Iran. And that is something that I think the district court certainly took into account, and something that that I think goes really to the heart of the importance of this case. That's really what it's about. It's about making sure that the reporters are there so that they can report and keep the public informed.
I just had a journalism workshop at the Council of Foreign Relations in New York, and a fellow was asked about this, and she said she covered the Pentagon for a long time. She said all the federal buildings in D.C., movement is usually restricted. You can't just walk around at the White House, you know, State Department, the DOJ. So the Pentagon was one of the few places where reporters could mill around and walk down to the offices. So I guess she wasn't surprised that there were eventually limitations that were put on that. I mean, can you speak to reporter movements in some of these other departments and how this might be different?
Yeah, to be, you know, I think that actually the way that prior to the policy, the way that Access worked at the Pentagon wasn't that different than what you'd see in other federal buildings, other places like the Department of Justice. To be clear, no reporters had sort of unfettered access to every place in the Pentagon. There are clearly secure areas, places inside offices. Journalists couldn't just walk into those secured areas. But hallways are unsecured areas. And it is a fact that the way that the Pentagon is laid out, different press offices full of press officials whose job it is to talk to members of the press, they were located in different parts of the building. And so journalists would walk through the hallway from the designated correspondence corridor where they worked on a daily basis, would walk to one press office, walk to another press office. It wasn't an unusual situation, I would say, at all. And I think it worked really effectively for many decades. In fact, the court concluded that it worked effectively for decades, both to keep the public informed, but also to posing no sort of concerns about security within the building.
In his ruling, incredibly well-written ruling, in my opinion, 40 pages, Judge Friedman basically attacked a couple of different, attacked the policy in a couple of different ways, including saying that it was vague, right? There was really no way to tell why or how it was being implemented. Also, that it was discriminatory. That being said, there are examples of policies that I'm sure you have lived with and that reporters could live with that are still, you know, that still allow the press to do their job, but that are not vague and not discriminatory. Can you give us some examples of what those might be?
Yeah, and I think if you look at Judge Friedman's order and what he did, right, he vacated certain provisions of the policy and left in place some of the what you would expect ordinary. You got to go through a background check to be able to access this building. Kind of viewpoint neutral, uncontroversial, I would say, requirements for a press credential. What the problem is with this policy that was struck down, the really fundamental constitutional problem, is that it gave Pentagon leadership the ability to suspend immediately and revoke press credentials for any reason at all, including specifically because they didn't like questions that were being asked by reporters, because they didn't like what was being published by reporters. And that is just something that journalists couldn't live with. That's why the vast majority of the Pentagon press corps walked out. They said, we can't work under these conditions, and their press credentials were revoked as a result of that.
Last question I have, Katie, is, you know, in many ways, this is one of the most dangerous times. Well, by dangerous, I mean, you know, the First Amendment is under attack. On the other hand, when you see how courts have been responding to the Trump administration, you're, you know, reminded perhaps of the strength of our democracy. You see this in stories we'll be covering today involving, you know, this lawsuits brought by Laura Loomer and Kash Patel. What's your overall take on, you know, whether the First Amendment is under attack or whether it shows that it's resilient enough to withstand these attacks?
The First Amendment is there to act as a protection, as a bulwark. And I think you're absolutely right. And Judge Friedman, who is a court judge in this case with respect to the Pentagon press credentials, his opinion really, I think it's a great read because it really does demonstrate how courts are applying the First Amendment, making sure that these principles that are so crucial to our democracy are being upheld. And we certainly on the sort of attorney side of things will keep fighting those battles and invoking the First Amendment, and we hope the courts will continue, like the district court here did, to enforce those constitutional rights.
Katie Townsend, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face Off.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com. There's apparently some consideration by Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito about retirement, or at least there's some in the Republican Party would like him to consider retiring before the upcoming midterms. Here to break it down with the latest is Josh Blackman. He's a professor of law at South Texas College Law of Law in Houston. He's also a fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Professor, lots of buzz around this. Obviously, being one of the older justices, there's lots of discussion on both sides about Alito retiring, right? If he retires after the midterms, there's the idea that the Democrats will control the Senate and therefore be able to block any nomination. So Trump was on Fox Business TV a couple of weeks ago talking about the potential retirement of Alito, who is, by the way, 76. And he said he called him a great justice. He said that he is prepared to appoint a replacement should he retire. And then he said, you know, in theory, it's two. It could be two, three. It could be one. The typical Trump kind of discussion. But what's your take on whether this is actually going to happen? I mean, of course, we don't know what goes on behind closed doors. We have no idea what Alito is thinking. We know that he's, you know, if you had to call some of the justices political or partisan, he would definitely be in the conversation. What are your thoughts on what Alito is considering, if anything, right now?
Right. So there are two kinds of justices, those who retire and those who die. Right? It's sort of gross, but true. Justice Ginsburg most famously passed away while Donald Trump was president, and she was replaced by Donald Trump. Justice Scalia passed away during the tail end of the Obama administration. Obama tried to replace him, and the Republicans blocked it. And those two retirement slash deaths changed the course of the Supreme Court. So the thinking is, if Alito wants a conservative to keep his seat, then he should step down with his Republican president and the Republican Senate. That would be now. Who knows what happens in November with the midterms? The GOP might lose the Senate. The other element is Alito loves his job. He loves what he does. And he's very good at what he does. He's at the top of his game. So, you know, why would you leave when you're at the top of your game? There's always this rumors and speculation. Last week, some pretty reputable people, Jan Crawford at CBS News, said, for sure, Alito's not stepping down. I'll believe it when I see it. He can do it in the final day of the term, and it'll be just enough time. So it's this sort of always this never-ending speculation. I'm sure it gets in the justices' nerves at some point.
Right. And, you know, Alito obviously is really among the most conservative members of a very conservative 6-3 majority Supreme Court. But, you know, him and Thomas vote almost always in a block together and, you know, are the most reliable conservative justices. So really the benefit is not replacing him with someone who is more conservative. I think it's impossible, right, to find someone more conservative than Alito and more reliably in favor of Trump. But the idea is you're going to appoint someone who's way younger, right, and possibly on the court now for 30 or 40 years, as he potentially did with his most recent nominees to the court, all of whom are fairly young in the grand scheme of things, right?
Right. I mean, the immediate effect on the court wouldn't be huge, but let me just say, Alito's effective, and as a senior justice, he gets to write a lot of important opinions. If you put someone new on the court, it's not clear they'd be nearly as effective at persuading people at holding majorities together. So in some ways, Alito might be more conservative than whoever he's actually being replaced with in a very strange fashion. But you're absolutely right. The long-term effect of this retirement would be to put someone on the court who's 25, 30 years younger, who could serve for generations to come. Justice Thomas is a little bit older, but he's shown no signs of wanting to retire. He probably wants to go out, as they say, in all fours, go out on a stretcher and serve there till they can't serve anymore.
Now, I know Ryan's got a question, but do you think that someone like Alito, who I think, you know, based on what we know, does relish, you know, his role in this court, do you think that that he particularly might be less reluctant to retire, given, as you said, I mean, he seems to enjoy it and he's really being effective. I mean, you know, overturning Roe v. Wade in the prior Trump term, possibly ruling in favor of Trump in the birthright citizenship case, which would be a major, major case. Do you think that he looks at his role in this particular makeup and this particular majority under Trump as sort of the apex of being a Supreme Court justice? Look how effective he could be in really advancing some things that were seemingly untouchable in prior terms.
Yeah, I think Alito would say he has unfinished business, right? As much as he's done, there's other things he wants to accomplish. And I don't know that he wants to step down now, but it's kind of like a game of lottery, right? If the Republicans lose the Senate and something were to happen to Alito, God forbid, I think it's likely to give him the Merrick Garland treatment. They just don't confirm anyone. Right. And it falls the next president to fill the seat. So you start playing roulette with your life. But then again, Justice Sotomayor, who's, you know, 70-ish, and she has diabetes. She did not step down during Biden. She could have, and she didn't. Justice Breyer, who was, you know, 80 but in very good health, did step down. I think people, when they get up there, tend to be very sort of stubborn, and they see it as their job, their seat, and they hold it till they can't do it anymore.
Is there a history of the White House, political parties, or even the public putting pressure on justices in these kind of moments as they look to elections?
Yeah, and it doesn't work. So the story was that President Obama, I think, had Ginsburg over for lunch or something at the White House. And he was trying to just sort of, you know, not pressure, but sort of nudge her. And apparently Ginsburg was like, nope, my decision. And the story was Ginsburg wants to be replaced by a female president named Hillary Clinton, I suppose. And that didn't work out too well for her.
The other point being, and again, like, picking up on the idea that it's a lottery, it's all really a lottery, right? Because there's famous examples of conservative presidents, Republican presidents appointing justices who they thought would toe the party line and be very conservative. And not only did they not do so, they became very liberal once they were on the court. In this term, I mean, we're covering here in a few minutes, you know, Trump's latest criticism just a couple of days ago of the justices that he appointed, right? He called them, he said they have very little loyalty. He said that some have gone weak, stupid, and bad. Very technical legal terms he's using there. So there's no guarantee, of course, that if Alito steps down, that Trump is going to be successful in replacing him with someone who is as conservative.
Right. I mean, it's one of these things where a president, once they appoint a justice, they lose control. It's often said that a judge is never more conservative on the day they're nominated, and they always sort of drift to the left. I think Trump is being unduly harsh on the justice that he appointed, but I sort of get his frustration. When he came to Washington in 2017, he didn't know anything about the courts, didn't know much about the law, he didn't know anything about judges, and he relied on people, I think, gave him advice that may not have been, in all regards, the best advice. So, for example, what issue matters most to Trump? Immigration, birthright citizenship, right? The power to remove people. that was not part of the equation of how they were vetting Supreme Court nominees in the first go around. Instead, they were focusing on people who didn't like, you know, the administrative state and hated, you know, the government. And, well, who runs the government? Trump. So I think in many regards, people they picked were not people lined up with Trump's own values. And that's the frustration he's vetting. I can tell you the second go around, if he gets another pick, he would not go down that same path. I think he'd look for other things in justices.
Last question I have is, many are pointing to the release of Alito's first book, which is slated to be released only one day after the start of the next term. And, you know, many are saying you can't go on a book tour if you're starting, you know, a very monumental Supreme Court term. So do you make anything of that?
I don't. I mean, the justices often release books in the October-November window. Justice Jackson's done it. Gorsuch has done it. I think this is just the time when he would get the most publicity for his book. I don't think, I'll be honest, guys, Alito may not even know if he's going to step down. All the people speaking for him are not him, and he may just decide the last day to call it quits, or he may not to. You know, it's all this speculation is fun. It's good for podcasts, I suppose, but we won't know till we know.
Have we seen a list at all of who Donald Trump might have in mind?
You know, Trump had several lists that he released during his first term. He hasn't updated the list since, so we do not have a list.
All right. Professor Blackman, what is the blog that you are part of?
Reason Magazine, The Vala Conspiracy.
Here we go. Thanks so much for joining us on Legal Faceoff. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Faceoff on WGNRadio.com. Well, teen takeovers have been a real problem in Chicago, with hundreds of teenagers swarming to a particular area, usually downtown, to take over streets and cause some chaos. It's led to vandalism, fights, even shootings. The city council and mayor have debated about curfews, making parents more accountable. But this latest effort involves getting help from social media companies, where these invites are spread among the teenagers. So we're joined by 6th Ward Alderman William Hall. Thank you for coming on Legal Faceoff with us.
Well, thank you so much for this face-off. Feels like hockey.
We'll try to keep our gloves down. But Alderman, yeah, as Ryan mentioned, these teen takeovers have been happening for a few years. The most recent example is about a month ago in downtown Chicago, near the Loop and the Lakefront. There was a spring break teen takeover. Hundreds of teens seen flooding the area. There was fights, attacks. There were some arrests. Including for assaulting a police officer. There was an emergency curfew to regain control. Is this just a group of teens blowing off some steam, as some say, or is this an actual public safety failure?
Well, you know, Rich, I look at it as a behavior health crisis. This behavior is abnormal. And the reason why it's abnormal is because some of the neighborhoods in which these children are coming from are abnormal as well. I mean, again, I always say, before we criticize the ones who are doing it, let's look where they're coming from. And I think we need to take a critical look at neighborhoods that have absolutely nothing that's relevant to this generation of young people. Parks are dilapidated, really no educational institution, 21st century, no access to health care, no access to healthy food. These are the basic amenities that are conducive to strong behavioral health, of which none are available. And I will say this, that again, I'm not justifying their behavior. I'm not saying that we don't need to take a hard look at what's needed to hold some type of accountability, but I find it very hard to kick kids that are already down further. And I don't think that locking them up is the right now solution. I think it's a every solution, including using social media companies for what they're supposed to be for, which is safe communication, which they're not doing.
You've referenced a couple of things there. Social media. I mean, certainly these takeovers are expedited, are organized by social media, right? And that's how they generally gather. What is your proposal, or what are you referencing when you talk about holding social media accountable?
Well, two things. Number one, we've had two meetings with them, and to that end, two with Meta, to be exact. A little disappointed. The disappointment was the fact that they agreed. Number one, they saw some of the images. They agree that these do, you know, cross that line, or they're very questionable. Where the disagreement lies is the fact that they don't want to be held accountable. As you see, social media companies are now being held liable for mental health dilapidations. Parent groups are filing lawsuits, predators entering the chat room. So it is evident that social media has gotten out of control. Their argument is, do not hold us accountable to any litigation. Don't hold us accountable to any fiscal responsibilities that come with takeovers and promise properties damaged as a result of people using their platform to promote what they say that they don't allow. So in that meeting, you'll be amazed at how many police attempts were made and how many times they said we can do better in that meeting. And so what we did leave the meeting knowing is that stronger relationship between police and social media companies would be built upon, again, communication, which has not been as consistent as they say that it needs to be.
Does that mean putting some checks on people's ability to promote gatherings like this, or that companies like Meta are more, alert to those things? Or what specifically could these social media companies do to avoid these gatherings?
Well, they can just do what they say on black and white writing. They're supposed to stop any images of violence. They're supposed to stop the promotion of violence, sexual activity. They're not doing their job. This is what we found out in the last 7 days. When we sent them images of things that were happening in Chicago, it was a right now response. But they have not given us clear answers on why that response had to come as a result of a 14-year-old boy getting killed, us turning up the pressure with legislation. And so what is identifiable a problem is the fact that once they get this information, they then take it through their own process. So they're getting information from CPD, and we must acknowledge the fact that our superintendent has been consistent. He's doing a great job along with those on the front line. And at the end of the day, when CPD sends them information, they decide whether or not this is a violation of not only their own rules, but First Amendments. So First Amendment, safety violation evaluations, they go through that whole process. It's not fast enough. It's not consistent enough. And it's something that we are challenging, because that's what we say. If you're not upholding your rules, who will uphold the accountability? Because we're being held accountable. Why not them for following their own rules?
Understood. Alderman, what about curfews? We've had other members of the city council, your colleagues, on to discuss this. What's your position on curfews and whether those will work to curtail these type of activities?
Well, Rich, I'm 41 years old, and as long as I can remember, there was always two curfews. Number one, that one that is literally on the books. Right now in the city of Chicago, after 10 o'clock, you're not supposed to be outside without parental guidance and supervision. That's the law. It's been the law long before Mayor Brandon Johnson, long before Lori Lightfoot, long before Rahm Emanuel, long before Daily 1 and 2. It's already been on the books. I think what we're seeing now is the urgency to expedite parameters when there's evidence of the possibility of violence. That's where we have to figure out what's the common ground. Again, criminalization of kids that are coming from war zones, criminalization from kids that are coming from poverty-stricken neighborhoods is not the solution. And again, I just came back from Colombia, Palenca to be exact, and Cartagena. They have zero violence with none of the amenities that we have in America. So it's to say that, again, environment does play a role. These chat rooms, these social media platforms are virtual highways in which there's no monitoring that's sufficient enough. All we're asking is one of the tubes, which is where my friend, colleague Chairman Hopkins is saying, let's line up a host of tools to use to keep the children safe and the city safe. But what's most important, though, is that we cannot forget that there are already laws on the books. And so the criminalization of kids is where we find the disconnect. And so when you put together words or you put together news conferences, deeming kids as the issue and not the issues they are facing is where we find the scales in balance. And so what we are hoping for is that social media companies invest in our community. So we talked about a parent safety summit, because parents do have a role in this. Guardians have a role in this. But again, who's guarding kids when, again, mama and daddy are working 2-3 jobs? Mama and daddy are single parents. This is the reality. Kids are coming from neighborhoods where the average income is $28,000. Poverty is $32,000. Those conditions trigger unhealthy behavior. It triggers violence. We cannot ignore the both ends. The need to have sustainable legislation and the need to sustain neighborhoods, not either or.
So what kind of concrete steps have you taken or can the city council take to provide those resources to these teens and young people so they don't have to resort to these type of activities?
Well, every alder is like a little mini mayor. And so I'm the little mini mayor of the 6th Ward. And so in my ward last year, 2025, we sent $50,000 to the Park District, to Hamilton Park, for a social media content creator studio to teach kids how to work these gadgets in a positive way. That $50,000 was sent last year. It is now a year later. We're just now getting to the RFP process to do the build out. That was menu money. Every alderman is given $1.25 million. You can spend your mending money on public infrastructure in parks and other public use facilities, such as schools and things of that nature. A $50,000 investment is what I've made. I'm not begging social media companies for anything. I'm asking them to match our energy. That's one way. The second thing is we're going to take a hard look in Australia. Right now, Australia has no social media for kids under 16, and they've constructed a country that has different infrastructure designs that promote safety. And so what we're looking to do is to be creative in carving out safety zones. Thirdly, we're going to hold our park district accountable. My colleague, Carlos Rosa, chairman of the park district from the 6th Ward, we got to update parks. These parks are literally as old as you and me combined, Rich, and I think that we can do a better job of giving kids a landscape. If the Bean was in Inglewood, everybody be coming to Inglewood instead of downtown. If we had the lasers and the light shows that they have downtown in Inglewood, everybody be coming to Inglewood for the light show. And so where there is no investment in immediate infrastructure, you give kids no option but to go. And unfortunately, when you can get drugs at a gas station, Percocets at a gas station, on your way downtown, let's get high, let's disrupt on the train, let's disrupt downtown. Change the environment, change the investment, you change the outcome.
Alderman, as a member of the media, should we be calling these teen takeovers or teen trends? I noticed that the verbiage from the mayor has changed a little bit. I don't know, first of all, what the reasoning is behind that and kind of where you stand.
Because takeovers are hostile. When you say teen takeover, you're insinuating that there's a need to come take it back, right? And so with that mentality shapes law enforcement approach. I was arrested as a youth pastor because I had kids coming out of a gym and it was a melee right in front of us. And so again, police officers came into the room, came into the space aggressive to get back order. So takeover is who's going to be the last person standing. So when you change again, language such as that, and again, we see this trend that now the wind is beginning to blow to Detroit, the wind is beginning to blow to Atlanta. And so what we want to do is change the trends. We don't want kids not to go outside. We don't want kids to see this a beautiful city. What we want to change is the trend. And that's where social media companies have a role. They can set a trend. They can make something go viral that I believe can change the direction of kids when they open up their phones and their iPads. So trend is different than takeover. Hostility versus possibility.
Very good. Alderman William Hall, thank you so much for coming on with us on Legal Faceoff.
Well, thank you, man. Hopefully I got the puck right.
You got it great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Christina Martini on Legal Faceoff. Tina is a partner at Deckard LLP and global co-chair of the firm's intellectual property practice. She has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers and Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. For more than 150 years, Deckard has advised the innovators who move industries forward. From the railroad pioneers of the 19th century to the world's top asset managers today, Deckard helps leaders uncover opportunity and unlock advantage. If you would like to learn more about Christina Martini and Deckard, visit Deckard.com.
Well, it's not often we get to speak with a federal judge here on Legal Faceoff. Judge Roy K. Altman was confirmed to a seat on the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Florida in 2019, becoming the youngest federal judge in the country and the youngest federal judge ever appointed in the Southern District of Florida. He got his J.D. from Yale Law School. He was projects editor of the Yale Law Journal, probably a good precursor for what we're going to talk about because he's now also an author. The book is Israel on Trial, Examining the History, the Evidence, and the Law, written by the Honorable Roy Altman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I think I was the youngest federal district judge in the country, but no longer. Now I'm just like a has-been, you know?
It moves quick. Judge,
it's a real pleasure to have you on. So I want to talk about your book, Israel on Trial. You propose that this, you know, literally centuries-long conflict should be examined through the prism of what we do, you and I, every day, which is practice law. I practice law before lots of judges. Tell us why you took that perspective in examining this conflict.
So, first of all, I didn't write the book as a judge. I wrote the book as an American who loves this country and who is very concerned by the deterioration, in my view, of proper methodology for assessing some of the most important contested claims going on in the world today. And so what happened was that after October 7th, I started traveling all over the country giving speeches in most of our 50 states, at colleges, law schools, high schools, churches, and synagogues all over this country. And when I did that, first of all, I met lots of my colleagues as federal judges who were very interested in the subject. And so I started a program with some of my colleagues to take federal judges to Israel, the first ever judicial education missions to Israel, to have them go see it for themselves, and then to come back to America and tell people what they saw. I mean, not in a prejudiced way, not in a biased way, just let them go see it, talk to Arabs in Israel, talk to Druze in Israel, talk to Jews left and right and center, and come back and tell people what they saw. And so what happened was our federal judges who went on these trips were totally transformed by what they had seen and inspired by a people who are resilient, who are willing to fight for the Western values that have been bequeathed to us, who are fighting and winning the wars of the 21st century, and who are doing it with love for one another, respect for their fellow man, and optimism about the future of Western civilization, something I think a lot of our judges feel, and I feel we could learn a lot from here in America. You know, in Israel, one of our judges said he couldn't believe every home, every apartment, had an Israeli flag. That's the level of patriotism in the country, left, right, or center. Here, if you drape yourself in an American flag, that sort of suggests something about your political ideology or your partisan preferences or whatever. Not there. There, drenching yourself in the Israeli flag is just part of what it means to be a model citizen. And so after the judges would come back from their trips, they would ask me to join them in their own states, barnstorming churches, synagogues, community centers, schools. And I've had thousands of conversations with people over the last 3 years about Israel. And what I came to learn was that the entire conversation, good, bad, and ugly, is driven by six claims about the state of Israel. And actually, when you peel back all the vitriol and all the emotion and all the diatribe, each of those six claims is a legal claim at its core. Is Israel violating the laws of war, genocide? Is Israel discriminating against its minority citizens, apartheid? Is Israel taking land that doesn't belong to it, settler colonialism, occupation, etc.? And so I thought, why not just apply the same legal methodology that judges, lawyers, and juries apply every single day in courtrooms and law offices all across this country? It's a time-tested methodology that we know works because we've used it for hundreds of years to discern truth from falsehood. And it's a methodology that we know we trust because we use it where truth-telling matters the most, in our courtrooms where someone's life is at stake, and apply it to each of these six claims and see what happens. And so that's what the book does. That's why it's called Israel on Trial. We put Israel on trial. We apply the methodology in each of the six chapters. Each chapter gets a claim, six chapters, six claims. We provide the relevant facts. And then in each chapter, we see what happens one way or the other. And I'm not going to tell you what happens because I want people to read the book. But that's the idea behind the methodology.
The judge applying... Let's just talk about one of those claims, genocide, because that's certainly one of the most used terms when it comes to this conflict. Many around the world are accusing Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli government, of engaging in genocide here. What is your, I know you don't want to give away the book, but you help us understand sort of how that term can be explained using the standards and methodology that you outline in the book, and whether the burden of proof has been met to establish that there's been a genocide.
So the genocide claim is a great example, right? The claim is not just not met, and we can talk about that in a second. It's frivolous on its face. That's the problem. And I'll talk about at the end why I think it's so important that we reserve the label for real genocides. But just to go back, the term genocide is the ultimate crime of crimes. It's reserved for a special category of offenses that have only happened very rarely in history, okay? And there are several criteria, elements that must be met in order for a party to meet the burden of proof that's required, the extremely high burden of showing a genocide. In essence, under the law of genocide, a party must have, a government must have, tried with specific intent, and your listeners will know this because I guess they're mostly lawyers, with specific intent to eradicate, eliminate an entire people in whole or in part based on their protected criteria, to use an American phrase, their race, their ethnicity, their religion, and to eliminate them as such, as a people. In other words, it's not enough to show that Israel just wants to kill every last Hamas member. They have to prove that Israel is trying to kill every Palestinian in Gaza. And there are several problems with that proof that show, I think, on any fair reading of the evidence, not just that the proof has not been met, but that it is the least likely case ever to constitute genocide in the history of urban warfare. And we can go through some of them. The book goes through it in great detail. The first, of course, is that Israel has the most sophisticated civilian warning system in the world. Okay, this is a point that is missed all the time, and it's very important. Okay, I had someone come up to me the other day and say, Israel is kicking people out of their homes in Lebanon. And my point to them was, don't you understand? That is a virtue, not a fault. Other armies like Hamas and Iran and the Houthis, they purposely try to kill civilians. They bomb them where they live and in their schools. Israel's doing everything in its power to remove civilians from the battlefield against an enemy who desperately needs to prop up civilian casualties in order to get the Western world to stop Israel from fighting so that that army can survive another day in order to kill more Jews. So Israel's warning system, which has sent millions of text messages, flyers, made phone calls, and social media posts to save the lives of literally millions of Arab Palestinians, is the most sophisticated civilian warning system the world has ever known. Don't take my word for it. The HLMG, the high-level military group, which is a collection of high-level officers and generals, not Jews, from almost every Western army in the world, has reviewed all the data, has reviewed the civilian warning system in great detail, and has submitted a brief to the International Criminal Court, the ICC, saying that not only is this the most sophisticated civilian warning system the world has ever known, not only is it definitionally incompatible with any claim of genocide, obviously, think about real genocides in history, the Nazis, for example. The Nazis put my mother's half-brothers and sisters, four boys and a little girl, in the gas chambers and murdered them, okay? Were they trying to warn the civilians to get out of the gas chamber, to leave harm's way? Obviously, the question is absurd just to ask it. The whole purpose of a genocide is to push the civilians into harm's way, right? To get them into the gas chambers, which is why all these Nazi scientists had figured out all these social ways to socialize the people to get them into the gas chambers. They would give them soap and make everything look like it was the showers and tell them they had to clean themselves, yada, 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 right? And so the whole idea of a genocide is you don't warn civilians to get out of harm's way. You're trying to kill the civilians, get them into harm's way. There's no better example of Israel's warning system in action than in Rafah, in southern Gaza. Remember that whole international outcry about Israel's impending invasion of Rafah? Well, Rafah is one of the places in the history of urban warfare where the ratio of militants, combatants, to civilians killed is the highest that it's ever been. In other words, more militants to fewer civilians than has ever been recorded in the history of urban warfare. Why? Because Israel spent months building an entire community, housing, food purveyors, medical providers for 1.2 million Palestinians, whom they moved over 10 days out of Rafah and into the Al-Mawasi camp. They then, by the way, went, and there was a rumor that there was some polio outbreak among children in Gaza, and they vaccinated, I think, something like 98 or 99% of the children in Gaza against polio. Would the Nazis have done that? Again, it's absurd even to ask that question. But the point is, the HLMG says not only is it definitionally incompatible with any claim of genocide, but they say our own armies would never be able to implement such a warning system. Why? Because our civilian populations in the West would never stomach it. And why is that? I was a football player. I was a quarterback. In football, as in war, what is the most important element? The element of surprise. By warning Palestinian civilians on the days before Israel is going to strike a neighborhood or a home or a particular section of Gaza, Israel is relinquishing offensive surprise on a daily basis. And in doing so, it's allowing time for Hamas to come into those buildings, booby trap them, and kill Israeli sons and daughters. If Israel wanted to eradicate the people of Gaza, as its detractors claim, Israel has nuclear weapons. It has the most sophisticated, or one of the most sophisticated air forces in the history of the world. It has complete air superiority. The Gazans don't have an air force. It could have easily done all of this only from the air and turned Gaza into a parking lot overnight, killing every last person there. It chose not to do that. And it sent its sons and daughters house to house in Gaza precisely because it is doing what the law of genocide and international law generally requires of armies in the field. It is moving civilians out of harm's way, and then it is attacking house to house after the civilians have been cleared. That is not only definitionally incompatible with any claim of genocide, it's also something we in the West do not do and have never and would never do on this scale.
Let's see. Fascinating stuff, Judge. We unfortunately only have a couple more minutes. I just want to ask you one more question because, you know, those who are using the terms and accusing Israel of things like genocide, apartheid, occupation, you know, they're in essence, in the framework that you put forth in this excellent book, they're in essence witnesses, right? And if this was a trial, they are basing their allegations on things like media accounts and, you know, the internet and what they might see online. If this were a trial, would these witnesses, in other words, would the media and some others, would they even pass the test of, you know, basic relevance? Would their witness testimony be admissible if this were a trial, or is it so unreliable?
This is a great point on both sides, right? On the Israeli side and the Gazan side. You know, I mentioned this. I gave a speech at Notre Dame, and I said, listen, there is a chief archivist at Yad Vashem in charge of 10 million photos and videos taken by the Nazis themselves, documenting the carnage, right? We have the scenes of the Rwandan genocide of hundreds of thousands of bodies laid out. We have the scenes of the killing fields in Cambodia of millions of people, right, brought into the carnage of the killing fields. But there is not a single photo, despite the fact that it's not the 1970s or 40s anymore, despite the fact that every phone in Gaza has a camera and every human in Gaza has a phone with a camera, we do not have any pictures or videos of any of the prototypical signs of genocide. We have no gas chambers, obviously, no crematoria, obviously, no killing fields and giant burial pits, obviously. In fact, because Hamas understands how important these things are historically, it has tried to concoct as if there were certain burial pits or killing fields where people were indiscriminately thrown in there. But when the international community has finally come in, after news reports have said, oh, a burial pit showing genocide has been found, they saw that these people were actually people who died in the regular course before the war even began. There's not one photo or video of the sine qua non of historical genocides, the firing squad, right? Every genocide in history has its prototypical images of a firing squad, children, adults, elderly people put up against a wall or in a burial pit and shot. We've seen them from Rwanda, from the Holocaust going back all the way to the Spanish Civil War. Not one photo or video of that in the entire thousands of pages of briefing from the South African legal team. What does that tell you, despite the fact that every person in Gaza has a camera in his pocket? And then on the other side, every genocide in history has the flips, the cooperators, the emails and text messages and phone calls that reveal that the government who's being accused of genocide actually gave an order, at least one order. Usually it's hundreds of orders to perpetrate the genocide in question. That's true of the Rwandan genocide, of course. It's true of the German genocide, where there's, you know, there's meticulous records going back many years of all the orders that were given. But Israel has taken the dramatic step of declassifying the War Cabinet's private confidential communications with the General Staff. And guess what that reveals? On a daily basis, not only has there never been a single order to intentionally kill a single Palestinian civilian, but every day the order came down to the General Staff reminding Israeli soldiers and military officials of the first rule of the IDF, which is to preserve and protect innocent civilian life, even the lives of the enemy's civilian population.
The book is Israel on Trial, Examining the History, the Evidence, and the Law, written by the Honorable Roy Altman. Where can we find the book at?
You can buy it on Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, at your independent booksellers, or anywhere else where books are sold.
Thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you very much for having me.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off, celebrating 11 years of legal commentary excellence. And it's time for the Legal Grab Bag. We're joined by a couple of familiar faces this week, repeat guests, including Nima Rahmani, president and co-founder of West Coast Trial Offices.
Lawyers, West Coast Trial Lawyers, almost. Three out
lawyers,
of
all right, there we go. He plays a legal analyst on TV as well, CNN, BBC, Fox News. You've probably seen him there. And on the other coast, we've got Mitch Eppner with Cudman Trachten Allo Posner LLP. He brings 30 years of experience in all forms of litigation, including entertainment, intellectual property, trusts, and estates. He's also been on the media circuit with appearances in the New York Times, USA Today, CNN, BBC. The list goes on and on. Thank you both for joining us. Rich, why don't we start off with Trump Watch, as we usually do. The president, in the midst of this ceasefire negotiation with Iran, decided he's got some choice words for a Supreme Court justice.
He's got endless time to tweet, as we know, right? Or Truth Social, whatever the hell you call it these days. But, you know, he spends all night attacking people like Bruce Springsteen, who we'll be covering here in a second, and late night hosts, and in this case, Supreme Court justices, which he's done over and over and over again, guys. We know that. We covered a couple weeks ago. We know he attended the birthright citizenship case in person. By all accounts, it's going to be a slam dunk rejection of his arguments against birthright citizenship. We know that it'll be probably a 7-2 majority ruling that the Constitution does allow for birthright citizenship. That means, Mitch and Nima, that many of the justices that he appointed will rule against him. And that is making him very unhappy. And in this latest tweet, he attacked again, not only an unnamed female justice appointed by Biden. Now, who would that ever be?
It's a category of one.
Yeah, it's a category of one. That would be Ketanji Brown Jackson. But he also went after what he called disloyal. Let's see the words he used. He said the Republican justices don't stick together. He said that they show very little loyalty and that they've gone weak, stupid, and bad. Like, Trump, knock off the legalese, would you? Like, speak to us in terms we could really understand. So my question to you guys is, you know, we know, for example, that he attended in person, at least partially, in his feeble brain, to maybe intimidate the justices, right? And we know maybe by some accounts, including one we had on the show, that maybe it worked a little bit. Maybe some of the questions that were asked orally were a little less tough than they would otherwise be. I doubt that any of those justices would be intimidated by him, but this has to be part of his strategy that he thinks he's going to bully them into not ruling against him in this birthright citizenship case. What do you think? Nima, what do you think of that?
Yeah, Rich, I'll start. And look, I agree with you. It's going to be 7-2, maybe even 8-1. You know, obviously, yeah. Alito probably in the president's corner, but even Clarence Thomas was somewhat skeptical. And obviously, the 14th Amendment was passed after the Civil War to free the slaves. So I think it's going to be 7-2, 8-1. And look, Trump has had a very good run at the Supreme Court. Okay. He lost the tariffs case. He's probably going to lose this. It's pretty clear on the plain text of the 14th Amendment. I do believe it's a tortured reading to say that children of people in the country unlawfully or who are undocumented are not subject to the jurisdiction. It was always kind of a Hail Mary fringe legal argument, but I don't think those justices are going to be intimidated. Look, this is a constitutional issue. It is a clear one. The president will lose, and he's already preparing himself for that rant on social media. You know, I don't think you should go after my fellow Harvard Law School classmate, well before me, Justice Jackson, or any of the Supreme Court justices. That's just, I think, beneath the office of the presidency, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Mitch, this is getting old to say, but when he does this, even if he loses, he wins, right? I mean, it's clear, and he's done this to perfection, that even if he loses the court case, he's going to win with a lot of his base by saying that, look at my victimhood, you know, poor me. I am the victim of stupid, low IQ, conservative Supreme Court justices. So in a way, he is still winning. Although I think that, I mean, the feeling is, it feels like that's dissipating a little, that people are kind of seeing through that and getting tired of this whole, you know, idea that you can still attack these people.
So, Rich, I'm going to agree with you by narrowing what you've said. It is true that all of his true believers will continue to believe him, but the number of true believers is approaching zero from the left rapidly. You know, his support appears from the latest polls to be trending downwards. Now, trends can reverse, but I don't want to let Trump off the hook about his racism quite so quickly. I actually overlapped in law school with the good justice, Ketanji Brown Jackson. I didn't know her then, but I knew people who knew her very well. And she had a reputation at the time of being one of the two most intelligent people on campus at the time. Now, unfortunately, the other person in that list was Ted Cruz, who, while he's a complete and total jerk and is a fool, is ridiculously intelligent. So the idea that Trump is attacking the Supreme Court justice for her intelligence is kind of like a dog attacking Einstein for being stupid.
Now we're cooking with oil. Mitch gets it. He's down for the face-off. Love
Absolutely.
It. All right. Well, controversy continues to build around FBI Director Kash Patel. He's been fighting some of these more salacious and scathing reports in court, but Rich might actually be digging himself in a hole by some of the things he's saying.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to point out we've got Harvard Law, Northern Illinois University College of Law. You guys better catch up. Let me talk close. Slower. Let me try to slow down for you guys so you could keep up with me.
Hey, but I didn't overlap with Cindy Crawford, and you might have. So I'm going
right. to go. Cindy Crawford from DeKalb, Illinois.
That's right. Exactly true.
Extra points for me.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you guys saw the press conference this week with Kash Patel, just the portion he was, you know, announcing this deal. He was with the attorney general, the acting attorney general, I guess, announcing this investigation against the Southern Poverty Law Center. And someone asked him about this, you know, report that he's been inebriated on the job, that he was his access to his files were shut off because he thought he was and then that he thought he was being fired in a pretty good response. We all saw the video during the Olympics of him chugging beers with the U.S. Olympic team. These rumors have dogged him for years. And by dog, I guess I don't mean that term because he sailed through confirmation, not with any Democratic support, but he's still the FBI director, shockingly. And the allegation is in this Atlantic report, guys, that he's not showing up to work. He has this perpetual problem, in addition to the other allegations we've heard of him using, you know, all sorts of government resources for him and his girlfriend. And now he's filed following the playbook of his boss, he filed a $250 million defamation lawsuit saying this was all hit pieces. Ironically, around the same time, a federal court threw out another one of his lawsuits saying that was, he didn't meet the legal standard to prove defamation. What do we think of this? I mean, Mitch, you know, the reporter, the Atlantic has come out. The reporter said she stands by the reporting. Atlantic is prepared to defend their reporting in court. But we know that Trump has successfully worked this model, right? And he's worked many, many settlements out of media companies just by suing them. Do you think it'll work in this case?
So I that's a great question, and I don't know the answer to whether or not the Atlantic will have the backbone. But I can answer that they should have the backbone because this complaint is garbage. In fact, the complaint concedes most of the facts that are in the report. His answer to the reporting that he was seen drunk at this bar at this time and that bar at that time is not to deny he was drinking in those bars, but to deny that he was drunk. I mean, that is a matter of opinion. I mean, and the, one of the biggest gets in that piece was the allegation with regard to this hockey booze fest that he went on, where he inflicted himself on guys who had just won the gold medal, was that immediately afterwards, Trump called him and said, don't do that. Don't go on TV making a fool of yourself chugging beer. And he doesn't deny that one. So I don't know whether or not this will work. I strongly suspect that this is a holding action because he feels, perhaps correctly, that while he's suing the Atlantic, Trump won't fire him. And what he's really afraid of, according to the Atlantic, is that Trump's about to fire him.
Right. Nima, we know that, you know, that the actual lawsuit is garbage. What I mean garbage, it's almost an insult to garbage because of the amount of typos in there that have been well reported by now. It's clearly AI driven. When you read it, you know, it's been reported by our colleagues at Above the Law just how some of it is so obviously AI. You know, his lawyer said, well, you know, because we filed it on the within 24 hours of the article, then we should be excused for a few typos, but It's just a garbage piece of bleeding.
Yeah, Rich, they're getting dragged on social media because of those typos. And look, I agree with Mitch, not a good case at all. And, you know, obviously, look, we know malice, we know opinion, we know truth, all that when it comes to the merits of the case. But I'm not just going to talk about the courtroom. I'm going to talk about the court of public opinion, you know. And look, I'm sitting here in L.A. and sometimes you file these lawsuits and it draws a lot more attention to it, right? So now everyone is talking about it, every hearing, you know, you start going through discovery. Imagine, you know, Patel sitting for a deposition. And I think you're right, and Mitch is right. I think he's on shaky footing right now. I mean, Bondi's out. Patel's made a lot of mistakes with respect to, you know, prematurely identifying suspects in the Tyler Robinson case, for instance. So I think it's probably a matter of when he's going to be terminated. And I think the discovery, the witnesses, the court hearings, depositions, all that are going to go along with this case are just going to draw even more attention to it. It's going to stay in the headlines and it's going to hasten his downfall.
No question. Ryan,
I think that Niamh is correct. If the case gets passed a motion to dismiss, and I have a feeling it's going to get dismissed.
Yeah, I think so too. And Ryan, I mean, we know now the playbook. I mean, Nima mentioned Pam Bondi fired, Kristi Noem fired after some public embarrassing, you know, performances. Bondi before the Senate, Kristi Noem with these commercials and the, you know, allegations that she was having an affair with Corey Lewandowski. In this case, you know, we have the Olympic thing. Trump is famously anti-alcohol, right? His brother died from alcohol abuse. He never has touched a drug or alcohol. So that there's that piece. Plus, he's been really MIA for many weeks. Plus, we know this will be the final nail. He hasn't brought any of the promised prosecutions in the January 6th case. He's promised that, oh, we're going to bring to justice all of these people who are involved in the, you know, in the hoax. He hasn't brought one. Now, pointedly this week in the press conference, he was asked, he said, oh, it's imminent. It's imminent. No, suddenly now it's imminent. Suddenly when his job is on the line, now he's going to bring, I mean, you can't make this garbage up, you know?
And it makes you concerned too, because he hasn't had many wins and there also haven't been too many things that he's had to deal with. There's been no Waco, Texas. There's been no huge incident at this point. Savannah Guthrie's mom could be a big win if they're able to ever figure that out. The FBI was involved, but still just crickets coming from Arizona. So we'll have to see. But let's stick with the Trump administration. Laura Loomer had a defamation suit against Bill Maher over Bill Maher, rather, over a joke he made on his HBO show, really more of an allegation of their, well, he alleges a physical relationship. Rich, a judge just tossed that suit.
Yeah, I mean, listen, we just talked about the First Amendment and how it's under attack and how thankfully a lot of judges are, you know, fighting it back, even those appointed by Republican presidents. This is another good example. Federal court judge yesterday tossed out this lawsuit by Laura Loomer, who is obviously, you know, among the most right-wing people out there who are in the trial. And that's a lot to say, guys, right? When you're classifying someone as on the far right wing of MAGA, you're saying something. But yeah, Maher said back in 2024, he suggested that in his broadcast that Loomer might be, the words were might be, in a sexual relationship with Trump. She sued him again. That's the new playbook, sue everybody. And she sued him and HBO for defamation, saying that it lowered her standing. I don't know that that's, you know, possible, but lowered her standing within Trump's world and cost her some opportunities. The judge said that the full context of the episode, when you look at the full context, that any reasonable viewer would have understood that Maher was just making a joke, not a statement of fact. He also found her, to Nima's point, that she was a public figure. And that she failed to show the what we now know as the actual malice standard, which is the higher standard under the First Amendment for a public figure. So thankfully tossed this one. But again, like, do these people win, Nima, by even by losing? I mean, is she able to now go out and say, like Trump does, that I'm the victim of this activist judge?
I don't think so, Rich. I think Trump is a bit of an enigma. He's able to pull things off. I don't think Patel and Loomer can do the same. And Mitch is right, too. Obviously, these cases, there are subject to a motion to dismiss. And the judge really kind of brought the triple hammer down, any one of which will satisfy an appellate court. First, the actual malice standard. We talked about it. Sullivan, famous Supreme Court case. And then, look, and the judge said, it's a joke, right? I mean, come on, you know? So the fact that she's not able to prove malice, and that it was a joke. And then finally, the judge said, listen, what are your damages? You know, right. You have zero damages, even if you prove your claim based on your own admission that you can't prove someone actually believed this and it actually harmed you in any way. So I think on any of those three bases, the appellate court is going to rubber stamp this. And again, I think maybe Trump could pull this off and he can leverage these types of settlements because the media companies got to play nice with the administration. Loomer and Patel and others, they don't have that same leverage, right? And I think a lot of the settlements, even though, like Mitch, I disagree with them, I think CBS, ABC, and the like should not have settled those claims, but I think they had business reasons to do so. And I don't think anyone has a business reason to settle with Loomer.
And Mitch, Nima just mentioned this, and we often cover this issue on Legal Face-Off. We explain to viewers that there are really two aspects of most cases, liability and damages. And in this case, even if she proved liability, which he didn't, as Nima said, the judge said that you haven't proven any damages. In fact, you could argue because, you know, the judge said you're still invited to the White House. Trump is still soliciting your opinion. That's worth actual money in any, you know, arguably, I'm sure the defendant made this argument. You probably made more money off it. If you're mentioned on HBO and you're mentioned by Bill Maher, you probably are leveraging that to make more money.
So, Rich, you and Nima are classier than I am, and I agree with everything that you just said. But I'm going to go to what the judge actually said with regard to actual malice. What he said was, even if this wasn't a joke, if you take a look at the evidence, given Trump publicly saying, I love you to Loomer, and Loomer publicly saying, I love you to Trump, and the two of them holding hands in public, there was a reasonable basis for somebody to think that, in the words of Bill Maher, if you have to guess about who's effing the president, it might be Laura Loomer.
Love it.
If we are keeping score, there's another one for Mitch right there. And the irony, of course, is she's known for spreading rumors and conspiracy theories. So, you know, this lawsuit is, or the defamation suit is kind of interesting. All right. Rich, we all know you are a huge Bruce Springsteen fan. You are planning to go to the show, what is it, next week at the United Center?
Absolutely.
How much Bruce gear do you have? Do you, like, when you, because you're at what, show 170 something? How do you actually still buy shirts?
I mean, don't talk crazy. 170. Those people are nuts. I've only got 146. So,
146. Okay, sorry.
The 170 crew is out of control. But I have one single shirt. I wear it to almost every show. It's a Greetings from Asbury Park t-shirt. But people obviously line up for merch. I mean, these days, guys, and Nima, you know this, especially where you live. You both live in big media markets. I mean, people, the merch business is almost not quite as lucrative as the gate, but it's almost as lucrative. I mean, you know, my daughter, who is right in the wheelhouse of the Harry Styles and Taylor Swift, she's 20. You know, she lines up for days. Some people line up for days to get the merch. Like, you go make appointments to line up for the merch. So the merch is a multi-billion dollar business in the age of not making money off recording. You got to make your money somehow. And these artists are being aggressive in protecting, you know, their IP. I think rightfully so. And in this case, the exclusive merchandiser for Springsteen, a company called Merch Traffic, went into federal court in New Jersey on Thursday. The show was a couple nights ago in Newark, to basically stop the unauthorized use of the, you know, the E Street name, the imaging, all their IP in these knockoff t-shirts. I mean, who has not been to a concert where the guys are out there before and after the shows with literally garbage bags, you know, full of t-shirts, and they're selling them for $20, $15. And of course, at the actual authorized tent, they're selling for $45, $50, $100. So as someone who does a lot of work in the space, I agree. I mean, you know, these bands do need to protect their IP. It's worth a lot. I'm glad to see that these companies are being aggressive in trying to seize and, you know, prevent counterfeit goods being out there. Mitch, what's your take on it?
So I used to be an assistant U.S. attorney in Newark, just down the street from the Prudential Center where this was going on. I know exactly where the U.S. Marshals and the Newark PD were going to be out there with this order, grabbing up the merch. And the thing is, some of that merch is counterfeit, and some of it just fell is genuine stuff that just fell off the back of a truck. I mean, it is New Jersey, after all.
Absolutely. Nima, you see this stuff, I'm sure, all the time. Is there any argument? This is Face Off, so we like people to take any argument. These are, you know, small business people, and they're trying to make a buck, and, like, you know, Springsteen and these companies are making plenty of money, so what's the big deal?
Yeah, but you got to protect your mark, right? And look, I'm here in LA, and we just wrapped Coachella, and like you said, you know, I mean, people are there for the merch and also for social media, right? So this is a big business, and we know at the events, right? I mean, look, we talk about the Live Nation litigation, right? There's the venues, there's the promoters, there's the ticketing companies, and the artists get a lot of money off the merch, right? It costs, you know, dollars to make overseas. They mark it up, and really, it's the brand, it's that trademark that sells. Everyone likes to wear merch from their favorite artist, whatever that may be. So it's big business. I'm not surprised they're doing it, and I think it's the right thing to do.
Mitch, you ever bought any shirts outside of a Knicks or Mets game from one of those vendors, like a good old Doc Gooden shirt or something like that?
There are at least five amendments in the Constitution, and I'm going to cite the fifth one right now.
Hey, I would ask you if you have any Mets gear, but obviously, I mean, maybe you could get it cheap now. I don't know. But
I'm a Yankees fan. I have okay. No truck for the team in Queens.
Mm-hmm. Ah, good. We thought we talked before. We thought you were a Mets guy, but we must have confused it.
We saw the orange and blue. And just
yes.
Yeah, that's about the Knicks. That's about the Knicks.
Okay. All right. Well, spoiler alert, giving away a plot could land you in hot water and actually cost you some big bucks in Japan. Rich, what's going on in this story?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Legal Face-Off covers the entire globe legal system, and this one comes out of Tokyo. I mean, it's an interesting case. I mean, this week, the Tokyo District Court tried and sentenced someone, 39-year-old guy, to a year and a half in prison and ¥1 million, which sounds like life-altering, but it's about $6,300, a fine for posting spoiler articles. This guy ran a website that shared detailed plot summaries of movies and anime, which we know is, like, huge. And he would describe the entire story from start to finish. Prosecutors proved that these articles were infringing on copyright because of the amount of detail they went into. And again, under Japanese law, the words are creating a new work by making creative modifications to the original while preserving its essential characteristics is classified as an adaption. So without getting too much into the weeds on IP, I think it's an interesting ruling, Nima, because, man, does that open up? I mean, if I, you know, go around telling the plot of, I mean, back in the day before the internet, like, you know, I remember The Crying Game, that was a big spoiler, right? The Sixth Sense, these were things that you would not dare utter to your friend to ruin it. But now I feel like you can find the spoiler to anything online. A lot of people will put spoiler alert. You now have to put, you know, spoiler alert so you don't get sentenced to, you know, a year and a half in prison. Do you think that'll fly in this country?
I don't think so. And like Mitch, I was at AUSA. I can't imagine, you know, prosecuting someone for something like this, for spoiling a movie or a show. It seems excessive. You know, obviously, we IP rights are important. We talked about it, but this is a civil matter, man. Come on. You're putting someone in jail for more than a year for something like this. Don't mess around with copyright law in Japan, apparently.
Well, one of my one of my favorite parts, Mitch, was that one of the cases cited, and there was two specific articles written between 2018 and 2023, and one of them was for an episode of a show, anime called Overlord. The second one, though, was the movie Godzilla Minus One. Now, listen, if you don't know how Godzilla ends, if you're actually prosecuting someone, it's Godzilla! Like, he's a big monster. Is this really an issue that you're wondering how Godzilla ends?
I'm going to agree with Niyama. This in the United States shouldn't be a criminal matter. Frankly, it shouldn't be a civil matter except for one tiny part of it. To the extent that they were literally just copying and pasting the scripts and publishing the dialogue, that really is copyright violation. But copyright doesn't protect an idea, it protects the expression of that idea. So you can sit and do a plot recap and you're not violating copyright, at least in the United States. But if you sit and you quote every line that was said and there's no transformative use, you probably are liable for civil copyright violations.
All right, we've all been getting sticker shock lately. Gas prices, ticket prices, grocery prices, college costs. How about legal prices? Imagine getting slapped with a $35 million bill for legal fees.
That's like one day in the life of Nima. both these guys, they're, you know, Harvard law guys. So this case involves a guy named Alberto Safra, who was hired some a law firm named WilmerHale to deal with some disputes involving his $23 billion fortune. Not surprisingly, that kind of inheritance does, you know, engender some litigation. We get that. But he hired WilmerHale, and over the course of 2 years, they racked up a bill, as Ryan mentioned, of $35 million, with about 18.9 of that still outstanding. The client, Safra, has gone to court in London challenging the invoices, which, of course, you know, brought this into public scrutiny. Usually, the public's not aware of these kind of things, and they don't know of these bills. But in a single day, guys, WilmerHale billed more than $162,000. The top partners, which isn't a surprise. We've covered these rates in the past. I mean, some firms are charging $3,000 an hour. These guys were only charging $2,100 an hour. I think one of the issues was that they had raised that rate, Mitch, without getting the clients okay in one case. Other examples were that some of the attorneys, you know, logged in about 19 hours a day over the course of quite a while. Nine people racked up 132 hours in one 24-hour stretch. So, you know, the judge looked at this and said that he did acknowledge that these lawyers had worked extremely hard under a lot of pressure. They should be compensated for that. But, you know, when you flash a light on some of these bills, it does look to the average person, let alone perhaps the average judge, that, you know, there might be a little bit of excess going on here. I don't know if there was or not, but that's what's being alleged here.
So I'll jump in. 2 points. First, I left big law because the idea of charging somebody more than $1,000 an hour for my time just didn't work for the type of clients that I wanted to be able to work for. But second, members of the Safra family carping about how much they're paying in legal fees is kind of ridiculous. And I know because I saw countless of these engagement letters when I was at big law firms. One of the things that they warn about is that at the end of each year, we may raise our rates. I have the world's tiniest violin for the members of the Safra family, and this literally isn't a rounding error. It's also horrible client relations. I mean, between WilmerHale and Safra, they should have been able to come to a conclusion before having a public fight about this. This is a lose-lose proposition.
Anybody, anything to add on that?
Yeah, I'm former big law too. It's been 20 years. Thank God I'm out of the billable game. I just do contingency fee work. But yeah, Mitch is right. I mean, look, I've reviewed many of these engagement letters and the fees are high, but you know exactly what you're getting into when you hire those lawyers. I mean, and again, it's giving me PTSD, but you work around the clock when you're at big law. I was billing $2,500-$2,600 on the regular. So when I see 18, 19 hours, I'm like, man, I can't believe I used to work like that. But that's just how it is at those big law firms.
Well, I'm not giving any of you three my address. All right. There have been three people sentenced in a bear suit attack insurance fraud scheme. Rich, how'd you find this story?
Can't make it up. Can't talk about it without the video. Do we have the video? A lot of people have seen it. It's gone viral. But yeah, these perpetrators were dressed as a bear. And they were attacking cars in California, in L.A., trying to defraud an insurance company. I'm still not clear sort of what the plan was, but they were also using these, like, claws, these metal claws, to tear up the back seat of these cars. And it's all seen on, I guess, a Ring camera. I mean, it looks not – I mean, if you look at it from afar, it does look like a bear, but the way the bear is moving around, like, you know, it would not be the work of a bear. And actually, if a bear did get inside your car, I'm sure we've all seen other great videos, like, the car would be absolutely decimated, right? Like, it wouldn't just have a few scratches. The car would look like Godzilla himself stepped on the car. But, I mean, you guys have both been in law enforcement. Have you seen any schemes where people have dressed up like animals before?
Well, Rich, I got to tell you, I'm sitting here in LA, and this story actually was pretty big news out here. Yeah. All sorts of scams, insurance scams, but this one is one really for the books, dressing up as an animal. People are going to rip off insurance companies, the government. That's a tale as old as time, but this one gets an A for creativity, but I'm glad they got some time. We can be pretty soft on folks here, but I think the fact that they got the 180 days is a minor miracle, and I'm glad the insurance commissioner and the DA went after these folks.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the days when people just jumped in front of moving cars that slowed down in order to create, you know, these fake injuries. But dressing up in a bear suit is dumb people doing dumb things, because if they review the video, they're going to say, wait, that was no bear. Mm-hmm. And if you don't think that they're going to review the video, there's no reason to get in the bear suit in the first place.
All right. Well, we like to end every show with a question to get to know our guests a little. And this might be a little hard one. It might put you on the spot, but talk about spoilers. We already talked about The Sixth Sense and the other one. What was the other one? I forgot the other one. Oh, The Crying Game. Right. Those were like pre-internet. Those were real viral things. If there is a favorite moment in a movie, TV show, sporting event that you would be really upset that you might prosecute someone criminally for revealing, is there a spoiler that would make you very upset if someone texted it to you, told you about it in your life, movie, TV show, sporting events? Let's go with put Ryan Borer right on the spot first.
Oh, man. I always find the people who record sports just being bizarre to me. I don't know how you guys feel. Do you guys like record the Masters and then go back and watch the whole thing later? I never understood that concept. Like, when something happens, I think that's the result, and that's it. That's done. Is there anything that I would have wanted to not get the spoiler? I my wife and I got really into Lost when that show was on, and I know we couldn't see the finale when it happened, so I'll go with that, is that we did, that was appointment watching for us.
Good. All right, that's a good one. What about Nima? Anything that you would have really been upset that someone spoiled for you? I gotta write mine down as we speak, because I got so many in my head.
Yeah, I got one, maybe even two. Yeah, but definitely, Ryan, I do not record sporting events. I get too many texts, DMs. I mean, as it's happening, there's no way. I'd basically have, like, shut my phone off or throw it away. I'll go with movies. I'll say probably The Usual Suspects, The Kaiser
Soze. Oh, yeah.
I would be pretty upset. Maybe the end of Shawshank Redemption, but I'll go with The Usual Suspects as my choice.
It's a really good one. Classic. Lisa, anything on your end?
It has to be the Cubs World Series, Game 7, 2016. If somebody would have told me how that came out, I would have been really upset.
Did you see it live or no?
I was so upset. I went to bed and my husband said, "You
Oh
need to
my.
get up now," because I was throwing a fit. And I'm like, "If you're messing with me, I'm going to kill you." He's like, "No, you need to turn the television on." So I did see it, but yes.
Wow. Not only did I see it live, I was in the ballpark for
Oh
it
my
in
God,
Cleveland.
I had a heart attack.
All right, I got a few. I we didn't plan this question, but I got one sports related, and then I got three movie related. So you'll have to bear with me. So the sports one is one of the seminal moments of my sporting life as a Canadian was Ben Johnson winning the gold medal over Carl Lewis, 9-7-9. It was one of the greatest moments. And then, of course, 2 days later, he was stripped of the gold medal because he was doping. But that was a crazy ending. And then three endings to horror movie. I'm a big horror movie fan. And these were all formative movies for me. And this moment in the film blew my mind. So Carrie, at the end of Carrie, the Stephen King movie, you think everything's fine. She's walking to the grave, the surviving girl. And out of the grave comes Carrie's hand, pulling her into the grave. Blew my mind. Shocking moment. Number one. Number two, end of Halloween, right? Michael Myers is killed. He falls off the balcony. You think he's gone. You think he's dead. Dr. Loomis looks over, and guess what? There's an empty space where Michael Myers' body just was a few seconds ago, of course, setting up a 40-year run for Michael Myers. Third one, Friday the 13th, the OG, right? The original. You think that, again, everything's fine. All the murdering is over. And then out of the boat, the final girl is in that boat, out of the water comes Jason and pulls her under. So for me, those were like great movie moments. And had some a-hole told me about it would have totally ruined the whole film.
And yet you just spoiled it for millions of people in Japan. So
Right, exactly.
we expect you to, and we probably won't be on the next Legal Face-Off trying to get out of Japanese prison. Chicago's Sixth Ward Alderman William Hall, Professor Josh Blackman at South Texas College of Law in Houston, Katie Townsend, a partner at Gibson Dunn, and the Honorable Roy Altman. Also, shout out to Ben Anderson, Lisa Stegall, Fortina Martini, Rich Lenkoff. I'm Ryan Breaux. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question? Just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget.